From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for October 25th, 2019. There are way more Halloween events happening this weekend than we have time for, so pick your poison and have a blast. Your division-leading Green Bay Packers are in Kansas City this Sunday night, and the Bucks host the Miami Heat Saturday afternoon and the Cleveland Cavs on Monday. A limited edition Nike Air Max 97 trainer, yes, we're talking about shoes here, they sold out within minutes of coming onto the market, despite the $3,000 price tag. What makes them so special? Well, I'm glad you asked. The soles are filled with water from the River Jordan. The trainers have been called Jesus shoes because, well, you're walking on water. Some Nike exec is going right to hell for that. Here are a few strange headlines from the past week. An Illinois man was arrested for allegedly giving police a fake name, despite having his name tattooed right on his neck. Scientists have trained rats to drive tiny cars to collect food. No, I'm not making this up, but you might want to double check your next Uber driver. And a Navy doomsday plane built to withstand nuclear attacks was grounded after striking a single bird this week. This probably shouldn't happen unless the bird's the size of Godzilla. In the studio today, we have Brian Kelb, Art Rothschild, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, Max, tough to follow some of the stories in that open, but a good week for stocks maybe helps me out a little bit here. Stocks pushed up against all-time highs this week with a backdrop of political uncertainty. Markets have seemingly gotten comfortable with the unknown, be it Brexit talks in the UK, Turkish military action, unrest in Hong Kong, or even the House impeachment inquiry. Stocks remain unfazed. Mario Draghi, who has been a key actor on the world stage, made his final rate decision at the European Central Bank this week as he leaves his post after an eight-year run. He'll be replaced by Christine Lagarde, who is no stranger to uncertainty herself, as she presided as the finance minister of France during the Great Recession. Well, as I said, a pretty great week for stocks. The NASDAQ up 1.9% this week to close at 82.43. For the year, up 25.3% when you include a 1% dividend. The S&P 500 up 1.2% this week, up this year 22.5% when you include the 2% dividend we've gotten so far. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed today at 26,956, up 0.7% this week. For the year, up 17.8% with a little better than a 2% dividend. The 10-year U.S. Treasury moved a bit higher this week to close at 1.8% after starting the week at 1.75%. That's a quick look at the week. Brian, you know, I think started off with something a little funner maybe this week than just simply looking at the numbers, and we'll certainly get there. But, you know, I think one of the conversations that we've been having maybe just between you and I, maybe not more broadly at the firm, is, you know, surrounding this idea that there's so many interesting topics out there that we can dive into, topics that we often don't get a chance to explore with clients because we're focused on the nitty-gritty of markets or we're focused on the nitty-gritty of you know, kind of their personal investment experience. But I think, you know, you start to look around the room at what kinds of things are our clients interested in? What kinds of things are we interested in? And, you know, how can we make those investments? How can we make those decisions that might be a part of our portfolio more broadly? I know, you know, you and I have shared together a number of things that we try to get into our own portfolios. I hear from clients all the time things that they're interested in getting into their portfolios. I wonder what kind of thoughts you have maybe on you know, what kind of role some of those themes play in investing.
You know, Kyle, this is kind of a bunch of different conversations coalescing to some degree, right? Because, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, stocks versus bonds or value or growth or whatever, but we're also building portfolios really for each unique individual that walks into the door. And we as individuals have different likes and dislikes. We have different things that are important to us or not important to us. And I think one of the ways strategically that we can really relate to our clients is to relate to their different needs through the nuances of things that are important to them. So kind of from the other end, then you kind of go, well, there's a lot of discussion these days about environmentally friendly investing, socially responsible investing, you know, shareholders versus stakeholders, or any number of different topics, liberal capitalism or whatever, and all these different kind of topical points that kind of allow us to invest in a way that's meaningful to us. And I think the conversation becomes kind of interesting as we get to know our clients and know what's important to them. How do we tailor portfolios to their needs? Just as a kind of a crazy idea, when you and I were talking before, I have this kind of personal interest in space, right? Well, there's a public offering on Monday that has to do with a private company that, you know, and I'm not saying that's a good investment topic, because you'd still want to analyze it based on all the other criteria that would make a good or a bad investment. But if I could make good investments and make them meaningful to me and how I want to live my life, I think that's a pretty fun thing to talk about with people these days.
Well, Brian, I think in the past, the challenge tended to be, here's a company I know I don't want to own, and so how do I screen for an investment manager that doesn't buy that company or that industry? And I think that the better conversation to have is, here's an idea that I know I want to have exposure to, like you said, whether it's space or whether it's exposure to biopharmaceuticals, if that's your interest, or whatever it is. How do I get that exposure in my portfolio if I don't already have it? And that's a fun conversation to have. And it makes you more invested in investing. It makes you really buy into what it is you're doing. I mean, ultimately, that's going to make you a more successful investor. It's going to, I think, convince people to stick around a little bit longer on those ideas that they think are good ideas, because ultimately you're invested in that decision making.
I love that point, Kyle, that something that interests you makes you more involved in that process. And I think to the degree that you have ownership in this, you'll be a more successful investor. But I think that there's a bit of a chicken and an egg in this conversation, I think, in that, you know, years ago, I think the expectation was, if I wanted to kind of focus on doing things the right way, whatever that means, that I'd have to give up some return for that now. And I think now there's a large school of thought, and I happen to believe it's possible that by doing things right, you can actually do better, right? Better companies and better industries with better employees, treating people better. And I think we know that one of our favorite securities these days in portfolios happens to be one of the better performers in our portfolios these days. And whenever that happens, and you can say, hey, I'm achieving some kind of personal goal while making a profit for either myself or my clients, well, what's not to like about that?
Doing well by doing good.
Yeah, well, that's kind of it, Joel, you know, and I think it doesn't have to be for everybody. It doesn't have to be solely your focus. But I do think if it matters to you, and if it's a way that we can, enhance either the relationship or your involvement in the portfolio, it's a kind of a fun and interesting thing to talk about these days.
Well, and let's remember that as investors, our first objective is the investment an appropriate investment? Forget all the other stuff it does, but does this provide the best risk-return profile for the category that we're looking at? And so, forget all the stuff we just said about how, you know, it can be a good thing for you to invest in things you're interested in, avoid things you're not. Ultimately, it has to be the right investment. And I think, right, as you say, what we're finding is there are a number of reasons why doing well and doing things the right way are ending up being the right investment.
See, Art's not saying anything. He just wants to make money.
I'm
right?
Just sleeping.
Right? Yeah, it's not fun.
No, I think you have to be very careful. I mean, what we're talking about here is investing money that you don't otherwise have well diversified and balanced into a portfolio that meets your long-term investment goals and objectives. And I think we have to be very careful not to just invest in fads and trends. Specifically, a couple ideas that really have bombed this year is pot. You know, people have been interested in the marijuana craze, and right, those things have bombed. Another one is artificial meat. You know, things like the Impossible Burger. It's like, great, you can get them at Burger King now. But I happen to agree with you on socially responsible investing. It's really fantastic that we can buy some really, really good funds that do well over the long haul by, you know, making responsible investments. So I totally agree with you on that.
Well, and Art, I think it's such an important point to remember that ultimately these are investment decisions, as you say. And so there's a lot of great ideas out there that maybe are terrible investment ideas. You talk about, you know, some of the startups that are out there right now, the scooter companies that are putting these electronic scooters, these electric scooters on the streets. And, you know, a lot of people think that's a great idea, but a company like that's losing $300 million a quarter. How do you lose $300 million a quarter on scooters? I don't know. But not all of these are great investment ideas. And so that's part of weighing this conversation is, yeah, this is a great idea, I'm really interested in it. Is it investable? Because not everything's investable. And B, if it is investable, is it something that I can afford to invest in, something that I should invest in? And I think, Art, that's where you come in. Brian, that's where you come in. That's where I come in, to have those conversations with clients to say, you know, this isn't a risk that I'd be willing to take, but the question is, what's it worth to you?
Well, and I don't think if it's something you want to do and it's a good investment, it doesn't matter which comes first to me. I think both are important, and there would likely be a subset of both out there that would somehow fit in your portfolio. So I'm not saying it's the end all to go, but I do think it's a topic that will continue to grow
I have to agree with you. It can make it more interesting, but you have to be very, very careful because our entire, and we've talked about this on a regular basis, our methodology around here is we hire managers to manage our clients' money in ways that we design. And so for those who have extra money and have a theme or concept beyond, you know, the things we're generally doing, it can make a lot of sense, and it does make it more interesting.
We're always very careful, Arthur.
Well, Art, I appreciate you being the voice of reason. It feels like maybe the Fed's been the voice of reason here for the markets now for a little while, and we've got now in 5 days a meeting coming up ending next week Wednesday where the Fed's likely to cut the overnight rate again. I think pricing in now in the futures market about a 95% chance that we go another 25 basis points lower here. And so, you know, as we look at the direction that rates took this week, at least longer-term rates higher, you look at the expectation that the Fed cuts next week, we turned an inverted yield curve a couple of months ago now into something that's starting to look a little more normal. Maybe not completely for the reasons that you'd want. You want the Fed to be able to raise rates and the longer-term rates to rise. But at the same time, you know, I think an encouraging sign that the market's starting to see that the slow growth we've seen might slow a little bit. Art, Brian, I wonder, you know, any thoughts on what we should expect from the Fed next week and maybe what that means for investors?
But my guess is there's enough pressure they'll do something and then maybe sit on their hands for a while. But I don't know, if nothing else, to the degree it normalizes the yield curve a little bit and we can stop talking about it, I'll find that useful. You know, because again, I think my thing in the last few months has been just that, you know, that what I care about is the underlying economic, you know, data. I care about what's happening, and the Fed's ability to manipulate it short term one way or the other is less important to me than whether the economy is actually growing for the right reasons or not. And if the Fed lowers again, and if we kind of take this negative yield curve idea out of the topic of conversation, because it scares people, you know, and that allows us to then focus on what's really going on. And you know, are we gaining some momentum or losing some momentum? We'll know soon enough, I guess. And I think that frees us up to have that conversation, focus on the Fed.
Yeah, I find it very interesting the way the Fed has really driven the market this year. You know, there was concern that last year.
And that's what I don't like, Art, right?
I like it at this point. I mean, I've gone from hating it to liking it. Mm-hmm. Last year, the president was browbeating Chairman Powell. He's doing the wrong thing. He's wrecking the economy by raising interest rates. This year, the Fed slows it down. They said, we're going to keep rates steady, and we're going to lower rates if things get worse. Well, I didn't like that because the market was ignoring if things get worse and getting excited about lower rates. Now, I'm excited about them lowering rates because what they're doing, it's an inoculation. We've talked about this before because of the major disruption that trade policy has caused on the global economy and the weakening that it's caused globally and that it could cause here in the United States. So the Fed, in advance of a problem, is proactively lowering rates. As you indicated, if it doesn't happen, we're going to have a problem. And I think it's had the desired effect. It's stimulated attitudes. It's improved confidence that we're going to avoid a recession and go forward, which gives the president time to negotiate whatever deal he's going to get with China.
Totally agree with everything you just said. My point in addition to that is, yeah, but the Fed doesn't make things, the Fed doesn't provide a service, the Fed doesn't add to GDP, you know, and I think while they can add to or subtract in the short run from our ability to get all those things done, at the end of the day, what I care about is, you know, are people getting raises and are we making stuff and making money and all those sorts of things. So,
well, and ultimately, definitely, Brian, the Fed is responding to those other things.
Understood.
It's not we control those things. It's we're trying to have an impact on those things. And so I'm in agreement. I think that useful to see some better economic data so that the Fed doesn't have to make those moves. But to the extent that those downside risks continue to exist in trade war and Brexit and a global slowdown, you know, I think at least the Fed's taking the correct action right now.
Agreed.
Which is to allow the market to try to to digest some of those issues.
And to some degree, someday, what I'll look forward to is the day when we don't have to talk about the Fed so much because it won't be necessary, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I think as the Fed lowers rates, one of the things that so many investors are going to see is that perhaps they need to expect a little bit less from that safe money. If you're sitting in a money market, your rates come down a little bit. If you're sitting in short-term bonds, you know, your rates are probably going to come down a little bit. But, you know, rate expectations are a conversation that we have on a pretty rate of return expectations are a conversation we have on a pretty regular basis around here. It's something I wrote an article about a couple months ago talking about how investors – as we look ahead, probably need to settle into expecting a little less from their portfolio than what they've seen. And you need only look at the 10-year returns through the end of September compared to the 10-year returns through the end of March to see, you know, if you look at 10 years through the end of March, up almost 16% for the S&P 500 on an annual basis. Just 6 months later, the trailing 10-year number's up 13.25%. And so, you know, more than 2.5% return difference just from 6 months of time. Where you start matters. And right now, we're not in a place where we were in March or April of 2009 when returns had been terrible for so long, when stocks were as cheap as they could be. We're at a place now where stocks, yeah, maybe they're not expensive, but they're no longer cheap. And so, you know, I think you need only look at that illustration to say, yeah, the expectation for the next 10 probably looks very different than the expectation for the last. Brian, I know this is a conversation, as you do a lot of planning with clients, that has started to make its way into some of our maybe projections for what account balances can look like. I wonder, you know, what you see as an opportunity, what you see as some of the risks to kind of the traditional measures of, you know, stocks are going to earn 8% and that's what you should build into your portfolio.
Let me just, I guess, Kyle, talk in terms of biases. If we can keep this as simple and broad as possible, we talk all the time about valuations, which you just alluded to, and interest rates and earnings, right? So if we take those three factors and look at the years ahead, you might say, well, valuations are pretty reasonable right now. So, you know, if they get higher or lower, it helps us or hurts us only because we're distorted one way or the other. So let's take valuations out of the mix. Corporate earnings, you know this, we've now potentially on our third negative quarter, but corporate margins in the last year are the highest they've ever been. So let's not debate for a moment whether they could get a little bit higher or stay high for a while, but there's an extreme bias towards corporate margins getting lower, right? Whether it's because labor brings wage inflation to the mix or whether we have some commodity inflation we haven't seen in a decade, whether it's price issues that cause some competition, any number of things could lead to having some deterioration in corporate margins. That's not necessarily great for stocks. And then on the interest side, kind of the opposite. Interest rates are the lowest they've been in a bajillion years, right? So can't say that we aren't Japan. Interest rates don't stay low for a long time. They could even get a little bit lower for some period of time. But there is a pretty strong bias toward interest rates getting higher. And so if the bias is over the long run, then interest rates in all probability will rise and earnings will in all probability fall on a relative basis anyway. That seems to me to put some pressure on stock prices over the next few years, you know. And that doesn't mean it has to be bad. It just means that maybe below expectations for some period of time.
Yeah, Brian, I think if we do adjust our expectations in advance of that, if we do prepare ourselves, you know, for an investor that's looking at retiring 5 years from now, maybe it means you've got to put a little bit more away than you otherwise would have. Because, again, thinking practically about what that means, it means that you might not get the same kind of returns in the next five that you did in the last five. And so, you know, I think it's useful to have an idea of what to expect because it helps us to take the steps necessary to get there. And I think the other point that you mentioned is if rates are lower and our expectations for stocks are lower, maybe it doesn't change as much about the way we invest as so many people would assume. Well, if the return expectations for stocks are going to be lower, I should just sell stocks and buy something else. Of course, the challenge is what else are you going to buy?
What's the something else? Yeah. You know, which raises a good point because, you know, there's usually somewhere to go, right? Not always, but I've had a lot of questions about foreign stocks lately. It's been a pretty rough, you know, run the last couple of years. And you know, stocks are pretty cheap. You know, now there's a reason they're cheap because there's, you know, Brexit and what else is going on. But there, you know, we're kind of focused on domestic stocks right now. It may be that we beef up other alternatives and take advantage of that and add to the overall return. I mean, there's ways to be successful even if what we're saying is true, you know.
Joel, quite a bit of economic data this week, as there are all weeks. I think a few things worth talking about, in particular the durable goods order, in particular, you know, some of the housing data that I think was a pretty big deal this week.
Yeah, Kyle, we talked last week about manufacturing and how there's a difference between sort of the soft numbers that they get from surveys and the hard numbers that they get from data like we had this week on durable goods. Those hard numbers are now starting to show more of a weakness in manufacturing, and the durable good numbers, you know, between September and August, orders for durable goods went down 1.1%. And that's a big deal. And a lot of that were commercial airline, you know, sorts of things and automobiles. But if even if you take out transportation, orders went down. And so, you know, we're seeing, as we alluded to before, I mean, it's a couple of things. It's the global economy shrinking and slowing down. And it's also tensions over the trade wars. So between those two, I mean, there's some weakness in manufacturing. And that's not the biggest part of our economy, but it's an important part. And it's especially an important part for stock investors because the S&P 500 is more, you know, dealing with manufacturing than our economy as a whole is.
And Joel, you and I were talking about the housing market earlier as well and kind of the volatility in pricing recently. And it seems counterintuitive that with inventory as low as it's been, that we would have seen housing prices fall, or at least the median housing price fall. And yet, you know, now I'm seeing headlines that the U.S. housing market's in a crash or nearing a crash. And, you know, I think that's probably a bit overblown given that we're talking about a month or two worth of data here that's pointing to that. But at the same time, you know, some concerns there from what we saw this week.
Right. Those are really volatile numbers month to month. And, you know, there are some trends that suggest that maybe, you know, housing is going down a little. But what we're seeing is, I mean, we've recently reached, you know, post-recession peaks in some of these categories in things like single family housing sales and single family houses that are for sale, which, you know, hits at the supply. And that number you referred to on prices going down, that was for single family new houses. And that's a very small part, like 1/8 of all of the houses sold in a year are new houses. And we had numbers from the National Association of Realtors this week that looked at existing houses, which is the bulk of the market. And it, for the 91st month in a row, the year-to-year price went up. And that hits at the shortage of houses for sale.
Hey, you know, let's keep things in context here. I mean, the IMF just lowered its global forecast for next year from 3.5 to 3.4. It's not like it went from 3.5 to zero or something. You know, I mean, there are some trends, you know, that we're talking about here, and some softness and short term, maybe long term, but not, this isn't a situation where things are, you know, moving dramatically in a different direction.
And for the U.S. economy, Brian, I mean, the consumer sentiment numbers came out today from the University of Michigan, and that they were down a little from the month before. But again, you don't look at it 1 month at a time, and, you know, because...
And down from record highs, right?
Right.
A couple months ago,
We're basically, you know, at an even level over the last few years, and it's a relatively high level. And what that report looked at was consumer spending. And as confident as consumers are in these reports, they're not spending money that you would expect them to spend, which is kind of a bittersweet thing because our economy runs on consumer spending. But the fact is that a lot of families have pretty good balance sheets.
Right.
So they can afford to spend later on, and that's going to help this economic expansion keep going.
And of course, next week, Wednesday, we'll have our first look at third quarter GDP, which kind of puts together all of these pieces that we've been talking about for so long now to get an idea of, okay, really, how does all this look for GDP? Estimates right now about 1.7% for third quarter GDP. And, you know, realistically, we maybe missed that a little bit just based on some of the news we've heard on manufacturing. But even still, if you're at 1.5 instead of 1.7, that's still far better than a negative number that so many, I think, have been assuming is what's coming. So, you know, some signs still of optimism out there, especially, Joel, as you mentioned, from the consumer. Joel, you want to put in a plug for the newsletter?
Sure. The newsletter comes out this afternoon on Friday. So if you don't already subscribe, it should be in your email if you're subscribing. But if you don't subscribe, either go to our website and look at where you can sign up for the newsletter or call your advisor. If you're a client here, you should be a subscriber because it's information that we put together ourselves here. Nobody else has it, and we send it out at once a month, and it's free. And so we've got a couple of videos from the recent Investor Outlook seminars. We've got an article from you, Kyle, on the recession, the next recession, whenever that comes, on how it's probably not going to be as bad as what we remember from 10 years
ago. Can you tell me when that is, Kyle?
I can't, unfortunately.
He doesn't have his watch.
He doesn't have his watch.
Well, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.